Please be seated. This is case number 53264, Franchise Tax Board versus Hyatt. Justice Sadie is disqualified in this case, so it'll only be the six of us hearing this case. And Ms. Lundvoltz, you're on.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Pat Lundvoltz, along with Robert Eisenberg, here on behalf of the State of California's Franchise Tax Board.
And this is an hour argument, folks, 1 hour.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 10 minutes then for rebuttal if I could. The court identified eight issues for discussion today. There is a common denominator to those eight issues, and that common denominator is the doctrine of comity. This court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, permitted the FTB to be sued in the state of Nevada, but with an important condition. The FTB is a California state agency, was not to be treated worse than a Nevada state agency in a similar case. As Mr. Hyatt himself argued to the U.S. Supreme Court, the reference point for the FTB's liability is not that of private individuals, but of Nevada state agencies themselves. If Judge Walsh had entered a $490 million judgment against a Nevada state agency after refusing to apply the Martinez test, analyzing for discretionary function immunity, or extending other protections like the prohibition against punitive damages, this court would reverse such a judgment in a heartbeat. The fact that we're dealing with a California state agency should make no difference to that outcome. The judgment against the FTB should be reversed, and all claims should be dismissed. Turning to the first issue the court asked for discussion upon, Mr. Hyatt's claims as tried should be dismissed under the two-part test set forth in Martinez, testing for discretionary function immunity. Our argument on this point may sound like it is taken directly from Bransdell versus Clark County. That was the public nuisance case in which a public official's weighing of evidence was questioned. Our argument is taken from that case because that case in its analysis is on all fours with the facts before the court. Element number one under Martinez asks us to determine whether or not that the acts that were tried, the acts that are at issue in this case, were the judgments or the choices so as to be the discretionary acts then of the FTB. Like in Ransdell, the analysis here begins with a statute, a California statute, enacted by California's legislature, setting forth its economic policies, that being that all residents of the state of California must pay personal income tax, and delegating then that determination to the FTB and the determination of a resident to the FTB. The definition of a resident, like the definition of a dangerous condition in Ransdell, is a very broad definition. And it is broad for a very simple reason. All of us lead different lifestyles. We all leave different indicia, different pieces of evidence of our choice of residence. And therefore, it is left to the discretion then of the FTB to gather those pieces of evidence and to evaluate those pieces of evidence. Like in Ransdell, the investigative acts are delegated then to the FTB for them to use their judgment and choice to gather those pieces of evidence. And like in Ransdell, the evaluative conduct, in other words, how you evaluate then, how you weigh that evidence, is also subject to the judgment and the choice of the government agency.
How should we consider the allegations of fraud and bad faith in this context?
Now, from the context of actually getting into whether or not that there is such an exception to the two-part analysis, I think that that is analyzed then in the context of the second issue that the court has asked us to take a look at, and that is whether or not that there is some type of an intentional tort or bad faith exception. If we look at the court's decisions in that particular area, the court has ignored the labels that have been appended to the conduct and have looked at the objective acts then that are at issue to determine whether or not those objective acts meet the two-part test. As to, in this particular case, turning back to the first prong, then, of the Martinez analysis. The FTB used its judgment, used its choice to determine what evidence to gather, when to gather it, to make a determination as to when they had enough, and then how to weigh that evidence to determine if, in fact, that Mr. Hyatt was liable for state income tax. For the court's convenience, we identified four categories of conduct that were at issue in this case that were tried to the jury. The first was the gathering of the evidence. The second was the analysis of the evidence. And the third was the resolution of the protest or the internal appeals process. All three of those categories were the product of judgment and choices of the 42 employees that were involved with Mr. Hyatt's audit as well as his protest. There was various organizational conduct that was allowed to be put on trial. The California legislature's determination that how to deal with its budgetary crisis was the enactment of a tax rebate program, a tax amnesty program, excuse me. That was allowed to be put on trial. Docket sheets that are similar to the litigation rosters that were used by FTG was permitted to be put on trial. The cost-benefit ratios that are used by the FTB in determining their budget before the California legislature was determined to be put on trial. I note that there is no quarrel, or there was no quarrel, in the briefs from Mr. Hyatt as to our categorization of that conduct. Also, there was no claim by Mr. Hyatt that there was some type of a dispute that warranted factual resolution as to the objective acts that were undertaken by the FTB. And notably, Mr. Hyatt did not cite, with one exception, to any statute that mandated particular conduct by the FTB. And the one exception that he did cite was not even a statute at the time that the FTB did its audit. And so to the extent that there is no dispute as to the factual and objective acts by which the FTB undertook its discretionary acts. Instead, Mr. Hyatt exclusively attacks the mindset with which these employees perform their job. He attacks that mindset and labels it as bad faith. And when we get to the second element, I'll discuss that in more detail. Element number two, though, under Martinez, requires us to determine whether or not that these discretionary acts were based upon the type of policy determination the discretionary function and immunity is designed to protect.
Before you move to that topic, Ms. Lundwall, I wonder if you'd care to comment on the import, if any, of the court's citation to Colthurst in the Martinez decision. As you know, the Second Circuit in that case recognized that in the context of an exception, inattentiveness or even laziness might fit within that exception. That seems to run in conflict with an evaluation of subjective intent, and yet our court did refer to that case in citing the rule.
I think that if you take a look at Martinez and its progeny, that there has been an evolution of the court's analysis for discretionary function immunity. In Martinez, while that there was reference to Colthurst, as well as in Boulder City, there was reference to Feline. When we move, though, into the ASAP Storage versus City of Sparks case, in that case, there were intentional tort allegations as well as bad faith allegations. But this court remanded that case, notwithstanding those allegations, for the district court to review under the two-part test set forth in Martinez. And in Ransdell, there were intentional tort allegations as well. And the court ignored the labels that had been placed upon the claims that were at issue and looked at the objective acts without evaluating the subjective intent then of the employees to make its determination that the conduct at issue did meet the two-part test set forth in Martinez. And as we go then to the second element under Martinez.
When we examine discretionary behavior by the actor or actors, What do you make of the allegations at trial that communications were sent to persons who may have knowledge about Mr. Hyatt's residency that included his Social Security number? Is that a matter that falls within the discretion of your employees to conduct?
Yes, Your Honor, especially when you look at this within the context of the time frame that was at issue. It was 1993. It was 1994 when the auditors were conducting their investigation of Mr. Hyatt. At that point in time, Social Security numbers were common identifiers. If you went to Smith's, they drew you a little grid, and they asked for your driver's license so that you could write out your check. What was the number that they put in that little grid from your driver's license? Your Social Security number. During that period of time that was at issue, the Social Security number was a common identifier, and it was practice then for the FTB to ensure that they were getting information about the right individual that they had under audit.
Then what, under the notice sent to Mr. Hyatt, which represented assurance of confidentiality, was confidential?
From the perspective of there was a notice that was sent to Mr. Hyatt identifying the Information Practices Act as well as the Federal Privacy Act. Under the Information Practices Act, which is a California statute, there's an exception that allows you to use information that is necessary then for purposes of your investigation. But Mr. Hyatt didn't make those contentions as to the notice. His argument was more that in working with the auditors, he had expressed concerns that he was an inventor and he was worried about industrial espionage. And so therefore that any of the papers that he gave, particularly to his business, would be maintained as confidential. And all of that information then was maintained as confidential. The testimony at trial was that the auditors maintained those then in locked bags and locked cabinets and locked offices and afforded him the full protection then that he had sought. At trial, it morphed into something bigger and something broader. And he tried to encompass not only his Social Security number, which was a matter of public record, his address, which was a matter of public record, but also his name. His name. As claiming that invaded his privacy, when in fact that the auditors identified who it was that they were seeking information upon.
One of the things the court struggled with in leading up to the Martinez decision was how do you fit law enforcement officers in the ambit of the immunity rule? If the court were to conclude that Faline is no longer law, how would you analyze the police officer that intentionally beats a suspect on the street under the first prong of Martinez?
That would constitute a violation of the law. There is, in fact, a law that says you can't do that, and there would be a constitutional right deprivation in that context. And one of the things that has been made clear from Martinez, as well as in Butler, as well as in City of Boulder, and if you look at the Berkowitz case as well, is that if there is a statute that mandates or that proscribes specific conduct, then that cannot be discretionary because the law enforcement officer in that context then cannot, you know, without, you know, just to be able to commit a battery and assault then on a citizen.
Even so a regulation that might prohibit police officers' behavior would be covered then?
I'm sorry?
Even a regulation that prohibits police officers' behavior in that regard would be covered, and therefore the immunity would not apply?
That's correct, Your Honor. From a regulation standpoint, then, if there is a regulation that proscribes the government actor's conduct, then, in fact, the government actor is obligated to follow that prescription.
Then, in this case, what's your understanding of a regulation by which the audit was to be conducted that was not fulfilled?
I don't believe that there was any regulation that was violated, that there was any regulation that was not fulfilled. And so to that extent, then, it's impossible for me to answer that question. And one of the things that...
Go ahead.
There you go.
the privacy requirements and notices, and those wouldn't be considered regulations?
The privacy, the Information Privacy Act and the Federal Privacy Act, yes, they would be considered statutes or regulations.
But you see no violation in this particular case?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And so we did that analysis within the briefs on how the conduct then was not prescribed by the Information Practices Act. It was not prescribed by the Federal Privacy Act. As we get farther then in the
market. So is it your position then that unless there is a statute or a regulation that the government actor violates, that the conduct is immune?
Well, my position is this, is that unless that there is a statute, a rule, or a regulation that prescribes or prohibits certain behavior, and the government actor is needing to use their discretion to perform their function. And then you've got to go to the second step of the Martinez analysis and whether or not that discretion then was being exercised to further a policy objective, whether it be a social, an economic, or a political policy determination, the type that it was designed to be protected then by discretionary function immunity.
Does that modify what was decided in 2002 by this court and 2003 by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
It seems to narrow it substantially.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. In the Martinez decision itself identified that the prior tests that had been employed by the court gave inconsistent results. And so to the extent that this court was trying to apply or to build in consistency, similar to what the federal system has done, into this discretionary function analysis. And one of the things as we get to the second part then of the test, what we have to look at then is whether or not it's the type of policy decision that discretionary function immunity is designed to protect. And I think a summary from the closing argument that was given by Mr. Hyatt's counsel at the time of trial really underscores this. They presented to the jury, after summing up all the conduct that was at issue, they said this: in sum, we have shown you that the FTB has acted as fact finder, prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. Ladies and gentlemen, you get to decide if that's fair. Ladies and gentlemen, you get to decide if they made fair decisions. Ladies and gentlemen, you get to decide if that's how your government should work. It was not the jury's or a judicial prerogative for them to decide how the legislature, as well as the administrative branch, the executive branch, administered then the decisions that had been made by the California legislature. I think that that illustrates then precisely that what the jury was allowed to do was to second guess the system that had been put in place by the California legislature and its administrative agency, the FTB. And to make that policy determination, that what we do is we begin with the presumption that starts in Ramsdale. And it says this, basically, that if there is a statute or a rule or a regulation that offers discretion, and in fact that the government actor is employing that discretion, then there is a strong presumption that in fact that the government actor was acting in furtherance of the policy enacted by the legislature itself. And so if we employ that in this context, what you can see then is that the FTB was implementing the decisions that had been made by the California legislature. Turning to the second issue, and I think that this is actually the issue that is front and center in this particular appeal, and that is this: whether or not there is an intentional tort exception or a bad faith exception to the analysis set forth in Martinez. The court's decisions in City of Boulder and in Ramsdale and in ASAP Storage seem to have answered the issue very directly as to whether or not there's an intentional tort exception, because all of those cases dealt with intentional torts. But the court still put the objective conduct through the two-part test in Martinez. And in ASAP Storage, there were even bad faith allegations, And in that case, the court sent it back for analysis in accord with Martinez. And as to whether or not there was a bad faith exception, when you look at Feline, where in fact the bad faith exception was first recognized, it cannot be harmonized with Martinez. In Martinez, we're told we cannot look to the subjective intent of the government actor. Yet in Feline, to prove bad faith, the only thing you look at is the subjective intent of the government actor. So those two cannot coexist. They cannot be intellectually harmonized. And therefore, why we believe that, in fact, the Feline is no longer good law. In addition, the operation versus planning test was rejected in Feline. And in fact, this court frequently, in adopting a test or a rule or a regulation, like the court did from the federal court, employing the Federal Tort Claims Act review, also adopts the case law. And that case law is uniform in expressly rejecting either an intentional tort or a bad faith exception. I note that I'm into my rebuttal time. I have not addressed all of the arguments, but unless any of the justices would have any questions, I'm going to reserve my time then for rebuttal.
I have one. Go ahead, Justice Stevens.
On the punitive damage issue and NRS 42.005, I realize there's different interpretations by each side here, but can you award punitive damages against a government entity like that?
No, for two reasons. Number one, for the comity analysis that is to be afforded to the FTB. California's public policy is identical to Nevada's public policy on that particular issue. There is no differences, and therefore comity would dictate that, in fact, that California's government agency should be afforded the same treatment as Nevada's. Second is that, as set forth in the Newport case, which was the U.S. Supreme Court decision that analyzed whether or not a common law that sovereigns could be subjected to punitive damages, the court looked at all of the policy and all of the reasoning and indicated the answer to that was no, that sovereigns were immune from punitive damages, and it set forth then its reasons why in that case.
Thank you.
For clarification, it's my understanding that at trial, FTB offered a jury instruction on bad faith that was contested by the plaintiffs in that case. And I'm just trying to understand what, how much of an issue bad faith was down below.
Well, on this particular issue, I can reference quickly. What I'm trying to do is to quickly, as far as answer your question. We provided the various quotes that came from the trial court, the record, when settling jury instructions, when in fact that the Mr. Hyatt's counsel then indicated that bad faith was not an element of any of their causes of action. During my closing argument, what I did is I pointed out that their bad faith hook that they had alleged in 2002, which was extortion, that they presented no evidence of extortion, and that their two experts had testified from the stand that they found no evidence of extortion. But in rebuttal, Mr. Hyatt's counsel stood up and said my argument was misleading because bad faith was not an element of any of the claims that the jury was supposed to evaluate. And so to the extent that their own counsel then identified that bad faith was not an essential element of any of their claims.
Thank you.
Ms. Lundvall, before you take your seat, and as we examine the question of the intentional tort exception, I wonder if under the second prong we should not consider that exception. Intentional torts do not appear to further considerations of social, economic, and political policy.
And what I would do is I would suggest that we look to as far as what the court did in the city of Boulder. In the city of Boulder, there were intentional torts not only alleged, but intentional torts tried and intentional torts found. But the court still went through the two-part test, notwithstanding what the analysis is. And in our briefs, should the court go so far as to believe such an exception exists, what we have identified for issues of law as to why none of the intentional torts were viable. But the more important thing, though, I think in this context is it's not the labels that are to be applied to the conduct, whether it be by plaintiff's counsel or whether it be as a conclusion then of the trial. What it is the court has looked to is the objective acts that are at issue to determine whether or not they meet the two-part test.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Longo. Ms. Bernhardt, on behalf of Mr. Hyatt.
Mr. Chief Justice Cherry, members of the court, my name is Peter Bernhardt of the law firm Kempfer Kroll on behalf of Respondent Gilbert P. Hyatt. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of our time for rebuttal based on the cross-appeal that we have pending as well. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, without exaggerating, this case presents the penultimate question. Why do we have government? And the answer to that question is in our Nevada Constitution. I quote, "For the protection, security, and benefit of the people," Article 1, Section 2. State of Nevada has a constitutional duty to protect its citizens, and this goes directly to the comity analysis. Comity should not and must not be granted to the state of California if such a grant would impair Nevada's ability to so protect its citizens. Nevada cannot give up this essential element of sovereignty out of some desire to maintain harmonious relations with a sister state, where the sister state has already disrupted the harmonious relations with Nevada at the expense of Nevada citizens. We proved to a jury in this case a system-wide process to get Mr. Hyatt's money, whether he owed it or not. And even today, the FTB is still unrepentant for claiming not to understand what it did wrong. It believes it should be able to engage in the conduct it did against Mr. Hyatt. The FTB doesn't say it won't do it again. The FTB says they can do everything Mr. Hyatt alleged. Even if all of his allegations are true, comity should let us have free rein against Nevada residents. I can run down the laundry list of egregious conduct that takes this away from discretion and ordinary investigative techniques. Anti-Semitic aspects. Taking on the cause of an ex-wife to provide a remedy by going after Mr. Hyatt. Personal promotions, meeting our numbers, using tax cases to meet numbers for a particular fiscal year. The auditor making a $24 million income error and adding a 75% fraud penalty on top of that. And saying, oh, I'm sorry, we can't correct that until you take it all the way through the protest. And let them look at it. Of course, 11 and a half years later, we're still involved in the protest. There were internal doubts. Do we believe the affidavits of estranged ex-relatives? This is really a tough case from Carol Ford. Penalty training. Let's use fraud penalties as bargaining chips to get money from taxpayers. Oh, we don't care if the money is owed or not. If we can assess a fraud penalty, that gives us great leverage to negotiate a settlement.
Counsel, you're getting into very specifics, but if you talk in terms of the Martinez analysis.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I believe the opposite, of course, of what my learned counsel has said. Martinez and Feline mesh perfectly. Discretionary function immunity doctrine was clarified in Martinez, but both before and after Martinez, not every negligent or intentional act was entitled to immunity. Before and after Martinez, no immunity exists for Nevada officers or California actors or agents who commit bad faith torts. The tests under Feline and Martinez are very reasonable and very compatible, balancing the duty to protect citizen rights with government interests to have discretion to exercise their policy functions. Feline recognized the very simple concept that is still valid and viable and being applied in cases that we've cited in our supplemental authorities numerous times. State actors, including Nevada actors, have no discretion to commit a bad faith act. So the court has asked us to look at this question. Does the test in Martinez mean that as long as the act is discretionary, it's immune? And I say that can't be, nor should it be, the law and our jurisprudence.
You touched on bad faith, which is part of this analysis, but yet bad faith seemed to be taken out of the equation with the jury instructions. Was that appropriate or was it not appropriate?
Oh, it was very appropriate. And the bad faith inquiry has to be done as a threshold question before you get to the discretion, because if by definition, a state actor cannot have discretion to commit an act in bad faith, then you have to have a jury evaluate that conduct.
But you opposed the request for an instruction on that ground, and now on appeal, it seems as though your brief alters the discussion.
I don't believe so.
Aren't you taking inconsistent positions on the bad faith issue in this case?
Not at all, Justice Hardesty. And I think the way we expressed it at trial and the way we express it here is that bad faith is an integral component of the elements of the torts. It's not in and of itself an element. It's not in and of itself a tort.
Well, then what is your position with regard to the rule in Martinez and several federal circuit courts that have examined that rule since Galbert, that says that one does not examine the subjective intent of the actor, but rather the objective actions taken?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of...
Don't all of the torts that you have, at least your, I think all seven causes of action, but I certainly six of them, require an examination of the subjective intent of the actor?
And I believe that's very consistent with Galbert, with Berkovitz, and with Martinez. And even the FTB in their brief say the focus of the second element is not on the government employee's subjective intent. And that's a quote directly out of Berkovitz and Galbert. So the first element of discretion absolutely requires considering subjective intent, because if you have bad faith at that level, you don't even get to the issue of discretion, which is test number one.
But Berkowitz, Galbert, and Martinez were all negligence cases.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe, again, that that's a distinction. But the interesting part of that is that in Galbert, there's even an indication that the Galbert-Berkowitz discretionary immunity test doesn't apply to negligent acts. That the example they use in Galbert is the driver that's committing a negligent act while driving in the course and scope of employment. So if you had someone going out to interview someone to enforce a tax policy, runs a red light, that is not going to be immune. So there's a negligent act that's not immune. And clearly, Nevada, through Faleen and through the cases that continue to cite Faleen, has said, we are going to hold our Nevada actors accountable and not allow them to commit intentional torts or commit acts of bad faith, which become evidence of the elements of the torts that we proved. So I believe that it is absolutely consistent that Martinez and Faleen have to apply because they deal with different situations. If, in fact, the purpose of the second test of the Berkowitz-Faleen-Martinez test is to make sure that government actors have the ability to take care of policy judgments or decisions, then I think subjective intent doesn't apply. But what do we have here? If this court were to decide to grant immunity by applying that standard through comity to the FTB actors in this case, then you have a threshold that no Nevada actor would ever be liable for acts of bad faith or intentional misconduct. And your police officer example is a good one, Justice Hardesty. And you'd have a situation...
Well, that's not entirely... Maybe my example is a good one, but your point is not entirely correct because... The rule does apply to circumstances in which the conduct is in violation of a rule, regulation, or statute, and that becomes a limitation on the right to immunity, right?
Well, I don't believe so. I think what the argument would be, if there has to be a regulation or a statute or a policy, then you would have to have something written in the California Code and in the Nevada statute or regulation that says, thou shalt not, in bad faith, go after someone to get his money when you know there isn't a case because you want to help the ex-wife and because you want to go forward and destroy a man. That would be the rule. You'd have to write that down. If you look at the FTB's own manuals, every single page of their training manual says, if in doubt, don't disclose. We talked about what was disclosed. And there was a comment by Ms. Lindvall that the inventions was all that was intended by the Privacy Act. Well, no, it doesn't say we will only keep information about your inventions private. And in fact, they didn't even do that. They sent letters to Fujitsu and Matsushita, the first licensees of Mr. Hyatt, and they included copies of the licensing agreement, in part, to send to these customers, to these licensees. So they didn't even do that. So when the question is asked, well, what does it mean when you pledge confidentiality? What does it mean when Mr. Hyatt specifically asks an auditor, because of the sensitivity of my materials, because of the danger of industrial espionage, I've got to be sure that if I give you these agreements, they'll be kept confidential. And your government says, oh, absolutely. And then without him knowing it, they send these letters with copies of those agreements to those licensees. Now, is that going to be exempt? Are we going to grant comity to say to the state of California and every other state in the country, Nevada citizens are fair game. Go ahead. Do whatever you want, and you will not be accountable because we're going to be nice to our sister states.
Well, assuming for the moment that the court agreed with you that there were some instances in which the promise of confidentiality was disregarded, aren't there other instances where the acts by the auditors were discretionary and protected immunity? And if so, should the court have bifurcated those which were protected and those which were not?
No, I don't believe you can, because in this case, each and every act which the FTB tries to cloak under the guise of discretionary acts was intended to reach the predetermined conclusion. When they did not choose to interview Mr. Hyatt or his neighbor or Dan Hyatt, people with firsthand knowledge of what actually happened, they made a discretionary decision because they knew that information might not fit with their case. Is that discretionary decision going to be allowed?
But, counsel, you're making I understand you're representing your client, but part of the underlying issue was when did he validly move to Nevada? And that's kind of a moving date that we're looking at, or they were looking at in this question, in terms of any tax liability to California. So at some point, I understand how you're phrasing this, but still trying to get to the issue is just as hard as he is talking about. Why not, in telling the story, if we're going to put it in a true context, could those issues not be separated?
Well, because primarily this was based on what the jury found, based on the jury's verdict here, permeating the entire process of the FTB, and that's exactly what our jury system is supposed to do. And very early in this case, this court in 2002 said, do not look at the tax correctness. Do not look at when he moved. This is not a residency issue. You can't decide that.
If that be true, then I come back to my initial question. Then why was bad faith, the instruction they attempted to get in, not at least given to the jury for their consideration, if that's what we're focusing on?
Because we are focusing exactly on what the Martinez-Berkovitz-Galbert test talks about, and that is the conduct of your state actor under the circumstances. You're looking at conduct, and that's what we examine at trial. What did they do? And did that violate Mr. Hyatt's privacy rights? Did that violate?
Were we looking at objective or subjective?
It depends on the subjective intent before you get to Martinez's test on whether or not it was discretionary. You have got to look at that threshold question in order to fulfill the duty to protect citizens.
Okay, let's examine that. Mr. Bernard, could you share with us your argument? I got the impression from your briefs that Mr. Hyatt's argument in this case is that a collection of what might be considered negligent behavior should be amalgamated into intentional misconduct. Is that your position?
And if
that is not your position, could you cite for me one example of an act which is an intentional tort or bad faith?
All right. I think that the question deals with two separate aspects of the case, and I agree that there are acts that might be considered negligent that become intentional. For example, the auditor lied to Mr. Hyatt's tax representative. She flat out lied.
Mm-hmm.
She came to him, surveilled his parking lot, went to the office. He contacted her and said, well, what were you here for? She said, oh, I was just doing some investigating. That might be something that would be negligence if she did it improperly. But then when he said, do you have any questions? Are there any issues that have come up? She said, no, nothing. When the same week and the week before, they had sent out over 100 demands for information from third parties without telling Mr. Hyatt. That is an intentional act. That's not negligence. That's not inadvertent. That's not happenstance.
Has this court or any court that you've located accumulated a series of negligent acts and converted them into intentional misconduct?
Again, I don't know of any cases, Justice Sargent, that say that. On the other hand, there are plenty of facts in this case that could be deemed either negligent or intentional, and the jury has spoken. The jury decided they were intentional.
Could you identify one of the acts that you consider to constitute an intentional misconduct supporting one of the seven causes of action, aside from her indicating that she lied about who she interviewed?
We've already talked about the promise to keep his licensing agreements confidential.
Right.
And those were sent out. That was intentional. There was nothing inadvertent about that. They knew they were attaching that to those letters.
So let's assume that the state of California is not permitted immunity as a result of that act. Should the trial then deal with the damages associated with that improper disclosure?
In light of all the other acts that we alleged and proved, and that's what this court said in 2002 and what the U.S. Supreme Court said in 2003, that it is up to the trier of fact to decide whether or not the proof, not the allegations, not the labels, whether the proof supports the elements of the cause of action. And that's exactly what we did. We alleged that prior to the 2002 opinion. We proved the case that we alleged. We proved the case we told this court we would prove. And the jury ruled in our favor. So that all of these acts, and we had a laundry list, and again, I don't have a lot of time to go through all of them, but there were a lot of acts that the FTB committed. There were things like the anti-Semitic remarks, the things that Ms. Cox would say to her friend when she thought no one would tell what she said. It's the same argument. You do something when no one else is around as a measure of character. It's a measure.
What were the anti-Semitic remarks?
Well, she said, we're going to get that Jew bastard. Jews make all the money. This is the type of thing she was telling to Candace Less, who was her friend at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She goes after the audit, after the investigation, and talks with Ms. Maysted, the estranged ex-wife, and says, according to Ms. Maysted now, this is nothing that we're presenting. Ms. Maysted testified. Yeah, she told me he was convicted. Was it because of evasion of taxes? Yeah, that's what it had to be. I assume that in a telephone call she told me that. Now, that's a personal vendetta that this auditor had against Mr. Hyatt. And the problem we have with the FTB is that at every level of the system where protection should have been there by the state, the system failed.
Can you identify any violations of law or regulation, perhaps?
Well, in addition to the Information Privacy Act, the Federal Privacy Law, you also had all of the policy manuals and training manuals from the Franchise Tax Board that are supposed to govern this kind of conduct. And those all were part of the record. We had evidence of the training, for example, where the bargaining chips were used, where a training manual on penalties had a skull and crossbones on the cover. It indicates a pervasive attitude that we're going to get Nevadans. Another piece of evidence that came in their manuals. They tell their auditors, don't contact the Washoe County Assessor. Because the Washoe County Assessor tells the taxpayer. And the taxpayer might be upset that we're doing this digging behind their back. We don't want Nevada to find out what we're doing. We think everybody that leaves California to move to Nevada is doing it to evade taxes. So most or all of our cases, we should impose a broad penalty.
Mr. Bernard, my understanding is that the training manual of the skull and crossbones was in one single training event, not a pervasive distribution among all FTB personnel. Was there, in fact, evidence in the trial that this manual showed up with respect to the auditors who did this audit?
Well, the couple of important points on that. One is it was dated August 31 of 1993.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the audit began. The audit first letter was sent in June of 93. Ms. Cox got on the case in October of 1994. In the penalty manual, and this was done for the Los Angeles District Office. Ms. Cox was in the Burbank office, but they were all part of the same overall supervisory function within the entire Franchise Tax Board. And what the manual actually said, the training manual, was, by properly using the full force of the penalties written into our tax laws, we may better be able to get the taxpayers to be more cooperative. Let's use the threat of these penalties to bludgeon people like Mr. Hyatt into paying things that they don't think they know, they owe. That was part of that training manual. We have Anna Jovanovich, who was the first protest officer, but prior to that, she was actually the legal advisor for Ms. Cox, telling Ms. Cox how she should handle this. She actually wrote or rewrote the fraud penalty portion of the 1995 determination letter. And in 1995, she told a training session that fraud should be assessed in many of our cases. That was the mindset. We don't care about facts. We don't care about the law. We don't care about proof. All we care about is using these fraud penalties. So, again, that evidence is circumstantial. We don't know if Sheila Cox was there. In fact, I think she testified she was not there at that particular session. But that was the mindset of the Franchise Tax Board, that these fraud penalties are great bargaining chips for us to get money for the state from rich people as part of an exit tax, in effect. We're going to stop them from moving to Nevada because they know we're going to come after them. We're going to make them pay if they want to leave California. That's the type of activity that Mr. Hyatt was subjected to. And again, the Franchise Tax Board found a man who was not only wealthy, but also principled, who was willing to fight them on these points all the way through. And there are a lot of other examples that we've got. You've got Ms. Cox. And again, she was a major player throughout this case. In 1996, she was transferred to a different assignment. She had told Mr. Hyatt's representatives that they'd have a decision shortly. Well, in April of 1997, she's brought back into the case, and she finds the case is still sitting there. So she calls Carol Ford and says, why is this case still sitting there? Is it because we have to make our numbers? Is it because we want this to fall into a different fiscal year? Also, the protest, I find out, was sitting on Terry Collins' desk for 6 months before it was even given to Anna Jovanovich, sitting on a desk. So what does Carol Ford do with that information? She doesn't say, we really made a mistake. No, she writes this memo to Penny Balke, and in that memo, she says, entitles it with all caps, heads up, Sheila Cox is upset. She doesn't want to take the blame for the delay, for the fact that she didn't even impose a penalty for the 1992 audit, for the fact that there was a mistake in calculating taxable income for Mr. Hyatt that was favorable to Mr. Hyatt. And they corrected that error because it would have meant more money from the state of California. Yet when Mr. Hyatt's lawyer says, oh, by the way, there was a $24 million auditor error in allocating income, well, we can't correct that one because that would be in taxpayers' favor. This is the type of thing Mr. Hyatt was facing throughout the time of the audit and after the audit, that this state should come in and say, hey, wait, we would not tolerate that kind of behavior from our government, our officers. The government makes a promise. The government says, we're going to keep this information confidential. And they put on the World Wide Web litigation rosters, which give not only the name of Mr. Hyatt, the amount of the tax he pays, and at one time, they added the penalty amount. Even though every other case on the litigation roster was one that had already gone through the protest, had already gone through the decision, and was being litigated in court under the California procedures, where there had already been a determination by the final highest levels of the agency. They put this on the World Wide Web with that detail. And you'll see in the evidence that the first time they put that on the World Wide Web, it didn't include all the detail. And somebody made a conscious decision later to add the amount. Somebody made a conscious decision later, let's go ahead and make this guy even more upset. Let's tell people that he's been imposed a penalty. And you calculate the penalty and there's only one penalty, it's based on 75% of the taxable income. Fraud.
What was the date of the posting?
Of the posting?
Mm-hmm.
The first posting was in April of 1998.
And that was after the complaint in this case had been filed,
the lawsuit was filed in January, and again, it's a...
Wasn't the initial posting of your client sued against the state of California?
That was the initial posting of our suit against the state of California. But it was not based on every other case in the litigation roster. In other words, there's no duty to put that in the public record, except that there further humiliation, embarrassment of Mr. Hyatt, and further indication that they're going to go after him and he better not be fighting them. If you challenge us, we're going to make your information public. We're going to let people know how much you owe in taxes, which, again, it's easy to extrapolate how much money you make. If you fight us, this is what's going to happen to you. And this is not something that we're making up. As soon as Anna Jovanovich got the protest, she had a conversation with Mr. Cowan, the tax representative, and she said, you know, most people settle cases because first we're going to go after a lot of information from you. You think we've been doing a lot of inquiring now. Wait till you see what we do this time. This is all going to become public. So most people don't want to face that. So we're going to go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and let's see if we want to talk settlement. Again, in a vacuum, that sounds like it's appropriate. But when later they send this incredibly massive information document request, they follow through on their promise. They publicize it. They put it on the World Wide Web. They did exactly what they told them they would do. Is that a threat? Well, whether she intended it as a threat or not, it was carried out. Should a government do that? Should a government use the power that it has?
The settlement offer you're referring to, is that the one that was in response to the legislature's adoption of the amnesty program, or was that separate?
No, that was separate. There was no settlement offer. It was a conversation from Ms. Jovanovich to Mr. Cowan in which she said most taxpayers settle to avoid us revealing all their public and all their private information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to talk settlement, let's talk. Well, Mr. Hyatt said, no, I'm not going to be extorted. I've been taught by my father not to cave in even to the government when I think they're doing something wrong. I don't owe any money. And I'm not going to pay them millions of dollars that I don't believe I owe because they threatened to make my information public. And as a citizen, he has every right to do that. These are the types of things that we were fighting, Mr. Hyatt was fighting, in trying to get information. Another example. When Ms. Jovanovich was helping Ms. Cox prepare the fraud penalty, Ms. Cox actually drafted it and said, we have affidavits from your ex-wife, daughter, and brother. Ms. Jovanovich changed that and said, we have affidavits from three sources. So Mr. Hyatt didn't even know when he saw the report that these are the people that were actually making these allegations against him. He knew they had no firsthand knowledge. He'd been divorced for 20 years, 18 years. He knew that that was not anything that could be reliable because she had no firsthand knowledge of where he was. He knew they didn't talk to him. They didn't talk to his son who helped him move. Same time period, and I'm running into my rebuttal time, but very quickly. The supervisor for Ms. Cox, Paul Liu, in the handwritten investigative reports, which normally don't become public, but Mr. Hyatt was willing to do that through this case and through part of the discovery, this court in 2002 said that these documents had to be revealed. Mr. Liu says, you've done your work, just make sure you write it up stronger against Mr. Hyatt. To me, this is government out of control. And it's the obligation of this court to protect Nevada citizens from that kind of conduct.
Also, on the emotional distress issue, there was some evidence that was excluded as to a loss of, I guess it was his patent, around the same time.
That's correct.
What is your position as exclusion of that, since emotional distress was an issue?
Yeah, and that was our, at least in part, relates to both our cross-appeal and their argument that there may be other reasons for the emotional distress that Mr. Hyatt suffered. And we believe, no, that evidence was properly excluded from the record in this case. There was no basis to bring in all sorts of other proceedings that were not directly related to the acts that the FTB was committing against him. That decision was a proper decision by the court after Judge Walsh looked at each and every aspect of the presentation, heard vociferous arguments from both sides. It's well within her discretion to decide that evidence would be more prejudicial than probative.
Okay, Mr. Bernhard, and hopefully maybe the Chief might give you a little extra time to answer the question, but on the punitive damage issue, you heard Ms. Lundvall's comment that basically you can't get it against a government entity, and certainly we've read the briefs and the arguments and all, but why do you feel it's appropriate to get punitive damages against a government entity?
Well, it's essentially the same argument on the comedy that we made both for the statutory caps not applying and the prohibition against punitive damages not applying. Nevada has redress against its own bad actors. Through things like a constituent, Mr. Hyatt could have complained to an elected official. Mr. Hyatt could have gone to the legislature, could have gone to the executive branch. There may have been executive branch actors who would have stopped this conduct from occurring when they learned what was going on. But Nevada has no power over California officials to do that. So Nevada must allow its citizens to bring lawsuits like this and have a meaningful lawsuit. So the $75,000 cap doesn't become a cost of doing business. And the punitive damages, there's nothing about California being sovereign in this state. In the city of Newport case that Ms. Lundvall cited, there was an award of punitive damages against the city. The Supreme Court didn't consider that. That wasn't an issue before them under 1983. But in that case, there was an award in the lower court of punitive damages against the city. If that is the only way that a citizen of Nevada who fights City Hall like this can find redress through the judicial system, then there is no reason for Nevada to grant comity to protect California and its whatever at the expense of Nevada citizens' rights. There are other remedies for Nevadans against Nevada bad actors. There are no other remedies. The caps expressly apply to Nevada. The punitive damage prohibition expressly applies to Nevada in our statute. It doesn't extend to another state, and another state under Nevada v. Hall, where California was on the other side, the U.S. Supreme Court said that a sovereign loses sovereignty when it crosses state borders, and it does not have those indicia of sovereignty once it gets into the other state. And we have the power and should protect the rights of our citizens.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bernhard. I'm going to give you your 3 minutes, and Ms. Lundvall, I'm going to give you an additional 3 minutes. You have 5:20, I'll give you 8:20. Eight minutes, 20 seconds, and Mr. Bernhard will have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In light of that, I'm not going to raise the procedural issue that, in fact, that while they may be the cross-appellant, the issues for argument today were limited to only the issues then raised by our appeal. But I appreciate as far as the additional time. According to the analysis that Mr. Bernhard presented to the court, is that before you even get to the Martinez test, what the court needs to look at is what allegations have been made of bad faith or intentional tort conduct. It's his position that before you even get to the two-part analysis under Martinez, you first have to look to see were there allegations of intentional torts or bad faith. That particular issue has been expressly rejected by every federal court that has looked at this issue. And the reason why is because what it would do is it would put the power of determining discretionary function immunity within plaintiff's counsel. All they have to do is, with a little bit of ingenuity or a little bit of creativity, plead around that. And so, therefore, we would never get to the Martinez test. And so, to the extent that the federal courts particularly have said that is not an exception, and for good reason, because looking at the objective acts of the government actor versus any kind of subjective intent is what is required then under determining whether or not that the immunity should apply. And in this particular case, I think it provides context to that particular rule as well. One of the issues that is frequently raised is the anti-Semitic slur that has been used throughout this case pretty much for its shock value. There's never been any allegation that, in fact, that Mr. Hyatt was chosen because of his religious preference. He never brought any claims against the individual auditor who he attributes these particular comments. And, in fact, she was one of 42 individuals. And she was third face. If you look at his audit and his protest as a totem pole, she's the third face up on that totem pole. There were other individuals who had chosen Mr. Hyatt for audit and, in fact, had begun the audit process. She simply was assigned to pick up their work. And there were many, many, many others after her who revered her work. And so to take Mr. Hyatt's argument at face value, what you would find would be this, is that all 42 employees could do everything right. Every objective act that they engaged in, they could do it right. And they could come to the right conclusion or the right decision. But if just one of those government actors harbored a bad thought, then in fact, bad faith could be alleged, and all of the rigors of the suit that was at issue here could be evaluated.
But it sounds like this person, and I forget the name, had a vendetta against Mr. Hyatt, maybe because of his ethnic background and all, and pursued certain action, didn't just shoot off her mouth, but she went and pursued a negative course of conduct against him, at least according to Mr. Bernhardt and what he referred to.
Well, according to Mr. Bernhardt, and that's one of the issues that I can go through piece by piece, the examples. We have painstakingly laid these out in our brief. But what I'd like to do is to highlight a few of these, if I could, please. Mm-hmm. Number one, he contends that when asked whether or not that there was a rule or a regulation or a statute violated, he claims that the confidentiality protections for purposes of his patents was violated. Why? Because there were letters sent to Fujitsu and Matsuda. Well, we asked Mr. Hyatt for the date of the receipt of income from those two entities, and he refused to give that to us. So we looked at the contract, and the contract recognizes between Mr. Hyatt and Matsuda, Mr. Hyatt and Fujitsu. And there's expressed within the contract, within the contracts themselves, that if the government is looking for this information, the government is entitled to that information. We sent a very simple letter then, after he refused to give it to us, saying, when did you send this income to Mr. Hyatt? And we received simple responses as to the dates of those income. That's example number one. Second example is he claims that the auditor lied to the accountant that had been hired by Mr. Hyatt. Once again, you've got to put that into context. She had been trained that, in fact, if you get telephone calls from accountants or attorneys, that you're not to engage them in discourse, but whatever your questions or concerns are, you're supposed to put those in your determination letters or put those in writing. So when Mr. Curran called on Ms. Cox and said, is there something that I can help you with? Are there questions that you have? She said, no, not at this time. That's placing it into context. In addition, they claim that somehow that the training manual dealing with penalties was some type of an indicia of bad faith. And furthering as far as the issue as to whether or not that this particular auditor had some type of a personal vendetta. Ms. Cox wasn't even at that particular training session. And in fact, the FDB has a settlement bureau. Auditors, protest hearing officers, everyone other than those who are involved in the settlement bureau are permitted to engage in settlement. The conversation that he attributes to Anna Jovanovich is a conversation that she had with Eugene Cowan, Mr. Hyatt's attorney. He had never been through an audit or a protest with the FDB. He calls her up and said, what can I expect? What is going to happen? And she relates to him then what the historical perspective has been with any of the cases that she has under protest. Similar to the alleged $24 million error. He claims that in fact that somehow that the FDB made an error. The FDB has long contended it made no $24 million error, but that the income that was attributed, the taxes that were attributed to that income was properly assessed against him. These are all issues that are on review before the Board of Equalization. These are all issues then from which Mr. Hyatt has an opportunity for judicial review in the state of California. But these are also examples of how Mr. Hyatt tried to allow the jury to second-guess those decisions. And when, in fact, then that you end up with a judicial inquiry and judicial second-guessing, these are the classic examples, then, of why discretionary function immunity is supposed to analyze the objective accident. Another point that there's one other issue that I wanted to identify, and that was this. Mr. Hyatt has always taken issue with the litigation rosters because, in fact, he says that my case was the only case that was treated in this fashion. Mr. Hyatt's case is the only case that ever had been alleged against the FTB anywhere. It has litigation rosters where it keeps track and informs members of the public of the cases in which it is involved in. And so when Mr. Hyatt's name and as far as that this litigation appeared, it appeared as a result of him filing this litigation. So the public information that was out there are what is on the litigation rosters. And he was not treated differently in the respect that FTB reported on the cases that were before it. But because of the uniqueness of his case, sure, he's the only person in that particular procedural position. The last point that I would like to leave the court with, and that is this. Comedy does not simply promote harmonious relations.
Finish your book.
Looking at and analyzing whether or not there is some type of hostility being directed toward the state of California is a function of the full faith and credit analysis, which was directly related in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision here, is that this court in 2002 did not demonstrate any hostility toward the state of California. Why? Because it treated FTB the same as it was treating its own government agencies. And that's what we are asking this court to do as well.
Thank you, Ms. Lundell. Mr. Bernhardt, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And just to clarify, there is a bad faith jury instruction. I may have misunderstood the question. Instruction 25 is the definition of bad faith, and that is part of every one of the jury's findings. Instruction 25, there was that instruction, and that was implicit through the jury's verdicts in support of each cause of action. And we had a couple of comments according to Mr. Bernhardt. Well, it really is not according to me. It's according to the jury. The jury heard 4 months of testimony in this case. And believe me, it was hotly contested. The FTB made every argument it could. We made every argument we could. The issue that we have here on our cross appeal is that we believe the court erred by saying that circumstantial evidence was not sufficient to prove a fact. And that fact was whether or not the FTB's actions caused Mr. Hyatt's business to dry up completely. And the court said, no, I need direct evidence. I need somebody to say I stopped doing business with Mr. Hyatt. And we submit that under the jury instruction and the rule of law that's been prevalent in American jurisprudence, not just this court, is that direct and circumstantial evidence can support each fact required to prove a cause of action. Now, after the mistake, if it was a mistake, the FTB has characterized it as saying, well, no, she didn't really mean circumstantial evidence isn't sufficient to prove a fact. What she meant was speculative evidence is not sufficient to prove facts. And again, that may be a correct statement of law, but the court made its decision not to allow us to pursue the economic damages part of Mr. Hyatt's case. So the amount of the award could have been very, very much higher if we had been able to prove and present evidence, direct evidence that Mr. Hyatt had the business, he lost the business, that Mr. Hyatt had worked with the Japanese companies, that the Japanese government approval was required for contracts in a licensing program like this. That's all direct evidence. The issue came up in whether it was circumstantial when we didn't have proof that people stopped doing business with him because of that. But we did have testimony from experts who would say, under these circumstances, the Japanese government and other in the Japanese industry would have spread the word about Mr. Hyatt and the tax investigation. The letter to Fujitsu and Matsushita attaching copies. So we think we're entitled to that. So we appreciate the time and the obvious effort the court has taken in going through the record in this case. I submit that in April of 2002, this court understood the facts. It understood the primacy of Nevada's interests in protecting its citizens. It understood the principles of law governing negligent and intentional conduct, and it understood comedy. 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. This court did it right. Now I submit more than 10 years since that decision, this court should do it right again. The rule of law is the same as it was back then. Outside the circumference of authority, the personal vendetta gives rise to a cause of action, which, if proved to a jury, must be sustained on appeal. That's our system. That's the rule that we have to protect Nevadans from intentional bad faith conduct, both by Nevada actors and by out-of-state actors. Any rule to the contrary is going to mean that the Nevada duty to protect its citizens is going to be severely, severely restricted. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, the court thanks Ms. Lundville and Mr. Bernhardt for your excellent arguments. This is a very challenging appeal, and the matter will stand submitted, and we'll